This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
When we first spoke, Trump was the president, and now we're speaking again, and he's the president again.
Uh-huh. That's true. Yeah.
What's different?
What's different? I think this time Trump and his crew came in with a much better understanding of how the machinery in Washington works and with a plan to do what's called shock and awe. And in fact, they call it shock and awe. So in a relatively short period of time, you know, so he was inaugurated on January 20th. And so we're essentially 40 days into the new administration, and he's issued almost 100 executive orders and 400 executive actions and proceeded to do a process of trying to cut current expenses that is also, you know, it's stacking functions to do other things. The one of the ways I describe it is they're canceling the old tools of the unipolar model because they're moving to a multipolar model. So they're building new tools. And so out with the old tools, in with the new tools. And because of the speed at which things are happening, many people find it very confusing. And that, of course, that is always the goal of a strategy, you know, that we know as shock and awe. So, but in many respects, what we've been watching continuously for 20 years in Washington is a financial coup that brings with it a building of the control grid, and that continues to steadily happen. So let's look at the first administration. One of the most important things he did during the first administration is institute a policy called Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56, which I refer to in short form as FASB 56, which took the financial statements of the government dark. Okay, so he ended all financial transparency. So if the policy basically says we don't have to obey the financial management laws, we don't have to obey the financial management regulations, and we don't have to obey the constitutional provisions related to financial disclosure and financial management. And he's been there for 40 days. You know, I can't think of any policy after the 81 executive order that Bush did that basically qualified private corporations to do highly classified actions. I don't know of any policy that more empowered the deep state than FASB 56. So when I say, you know, stopping the deep state is narrative, it's not. And of course, he's been in for 40 days and there's been no effort to reverse FASB 56 that I or anybody else I know has heard of. So in fact, and if you look at what Trump did to build the control grid in the first administration with warp speed, so he put $18 billion behind a military operation to basically poison Americans that has killed or disabled millions of Americans. So, you know, within two or three days, he announces Stargate, which is essentially Warp Speed 2.0, building data centers all over the country and announcing specialized mRNA vaccinations. And we see a real push for mRNA vaccinations in the United States, not just for humans, but for livestock. Apparently, the new measles, Polly Tommy just told me, is supposed to be an mRNA vaccination. And there are now fights. We now have 20 states with legislation submitted to try and outlaw mRNA technology at the state level, because states do, under the Constitution, have senior control of health policy. So, you know, there's a real battle coming on, but Trump has put major, you know, the power of the White House, the presidency, and this announcement of $500 billion of so-called private investment, but led by all the big tech government contractors. So I'm assuming ultimately the money's probably going to come from the taxpayer.
But go on.
Yeah, of course he knows. We're talking about a very intelligent man. He knows exactly what he's doing. And he comes out with an order to say no CBDCs, but he's pushing ahead on private CBDCs. So if you look at what's happening with the crypto initiatives, we can talk about that in detail. He's pushing ahead. And of course, the notion, you know, I keep telling everybody the notion that the bureaucracy is the deep state. That's like saying that the night shift at Burger King runs Mr. Global. Do you know what I mean? It's ridiculous. So one of the things you need to get an all digital control grid is you need the federal government run by corporate contractors. You need to get rid of the civil service because the civil service is going to require written instructions that match the laws that Congress has passed. So, you know, in my experience, the way you sabotage congressional orders is you have corporate contractors who instead do a side report to the deep state. And I can tell you chapter and verse and stories on that. But if you look at what they're doing, they're basically stripping out the civil service so you can run the government by private corporations.
Is that what Doge is all about? And in fact, is that why he has Musk as his right-hand man?
So, you know, I will tell you, it looks to me like Doge, you know, if you look at Musk, Musk is not a person, he's an operation, right? You know, and it's a big operation. It involves a lot of people. You know, if you look at, it takes, you know, one very remarkable person to run any of the six companies. So we got six people running six companies. You got somebody who's tweeting 24/7. That's another three people. You've got, you know, events all over the world. That's how many people. So, you know, Musk is a big operation. Now, Musk is technically a government special employee who reports to Susie Wiles, the chief of staff. And Doge is a governmental organization that's run by, you know, somebody who's been appointed to run it. So the question is, what is Doge doing? Doge's stated purpose is to cut current expenses. And what it's doing is it's put people, it's spreading people who work for Doge throughout the administration, and it's doing a variety of things that cut current expenses. And as it cut current expenses, it's generating lots of headlines about waste in government. Now, what we also see is a process of accessing databases and systems, and in a way that there are serious questions about whether this data is being privatized and whether it's being privatized illegally and hooked up with AI. And, you know, and there's been Wired Magazine in particular is doing very good coverage of what seems to be happening. But I suspect from at least the coverage we have that we've seen a lot of laws broken, and it would not surprise me if we've seen either AI inserted into government systems or a dramatic amount of government data moved over and privatized into AI. So there is a process going on with government systems. Now, if you look at the cuts they say they want to get, they say they want to cut $2 trillion a year. There's no way you can do that without radical changes in the three primary expenses. The first being interest on the debt, the second being military expenses, and the third being sort of income support and healthcare. Healthcare has ballooned tremendously. The more you poison the population, the sicker they get. And we know on a per capita basis, the U.S. health system is dramatically more expensive than any in the world. I mean, we pay on a per capita basis double what Switzerland pays, which is, you know, ridiculous. So, and that's why there's a real push to reform how the healthcare system is done, because literally you cannot afford the expense of it.
What about the foreign aid cuts, USAID, for example?
So the USAID cuts are it's a mix of things, but let's go back to the unipolar model. The U.S. was running a global empire, and as the Secretary of State Rubio has said, we are no longer going to run a unipolar. We have to shift to a multipolar world. So what that means is when it comes to diplomacy and the projection of power, the tools you're going to use are very different. you know, and in part because technology is changing. So remember, what does Elon Musk, one of his companies, do? He's building the, one of the greatest surveillance networks in the world, right? Starlink, SpaceX, so global satellites. That's a surveillance system. Okay. So if you look at USAID, USAID was one of the ways that you go into a country and you get everybody on the payroll. You used NGOs in a variety of ways to exercise soft power. You hire people, you get them on the payroll, you get them busy, you get them doing, you know, some things to get them out of the way, some things to pay them back for helping you with whatever you're up to, and some to do things like color revolutions. But it's basically a tool of soft power. And if you look at a great deal of what you've been reading that they've been canceling, I think they're things we would all love to see canceled, because they're terrible, terrible. To me, there's a terrible waste of money. But, you know, it's no different than all the defense contractors who've been spending, overspending for decades, because you want to hire and get all the people on the payroll. Same thing.
But isn't that part of the PSYOP? Trump and Musk saying and making all the right sounds, and you can't help but nod along.
Well, if you look, the president gave a speech to Congress on Tuesday night, and he went through many of the things he's done in the first 40 days, and a lot of them were good things. You know, so if you look at what the other, you know, this is one side of the uniparty. If you look at what the other side was doing, they were doing a huge amount of things that, you know, whether to exercise soft power or to get people to transgender or whatever, they were spending a huge amount of money on things which most of us find deeply offensive. And he's canceled a lot of that, or is trying to cancel a lot of that. And I, you know, good for him. So there was a lot that USAID was doing, including like censorship, that most Americans don't, and certainly his base doesn't want to see happening. And so he's canceled a lot of that stuff. And I think that's a great way to save money. And now, are they using that to justify some of the other things they're doing, which I would say are massive violations of the law and have phenomenal conflicts of interest? I mean, the danger of crony capitalism here, I think, is very, very real. And we can go through some of the conflicts of interest between Musk and what he's been up to, and what some of the possible violations of the law, of which I think are pretty frightening. But, you know, if you look at his canceling the U.S. participation in the WHO or the Paris Climate Agreement, many of us who've been fighting those things are very relieved. So you have to remember, you know, he's trying to please the pro-decentralization team and the pro-centralization team at the same time. Because he's telling the pro-centralization team, I'm going to end censorship, I'm going to get out of the WHO, I'm going to get out of the Paris Agreement, and everybody's happy. But meantime, he's launching Warp Speed 2.0 and promoting mRNA vaccinations and, you know, promoting digital IDs and stripping out the civil service so that the bankers can control the fiscal policy. You know, at the same time he's doing all these wonderful things, he's building the control grid. And I think you have to see clearly, you know, what's happening in both respects, because, you know, I hate to say this, if you look at every good thing he's doing on the side of decentralization, once that control grid snaps into place, bam, you're in the digital concentration camp and they can reverse everything. And I'm always saying to a lot of the freedom fighters, why are you fighting for this? Because as soon as they get financial transaction control, you're toast, you're a slave, and all this is gone. So question, you know, let's pose this as a series of unanswered questions. The data that Musk and his team were accessing are literally worth trillions of dollars. I mean, if you can take the data that is in the Treasury, in Social Security, in all the different parts of government, and suck that into your AI, you know, you're talking about creating trillions of dollars of value on the market cap of a private company who's building AI. It's extraordinary. And it's interesting, according to public reports, Musk is out in the private markets raising capital for SpaceX, for Grok, for XAI, which is the AI company, and for X, all while this is going on. So, you know, if you're in the private markets, that it's inconceivable to me that the access to that data hasn't significantly increased the market capitalization value of those companies as Musk is raising capital on them. Okay, so that's number one. Now, if you look at that data, if it has been accessed in the way that's been reported by Wired magazine and others, then there are clearly violations of the privacy laws. And so that's number one. As I said, Musk is a government special employee, and it is against the law for government special employee to be involved in matters that affect their personal pocketbook. Any data going to AI or to his allies' AI should be a violation of that law. So let me give you an example. He announced that when the OpenAI offer by Musk didn't work, he announced a greater integration with the Palantir AI. That was January 27th. For the next, when I did the calculation about a week and a half ago, Palantir's stock had gone up $129 billion in market cap. So somebody thought some value creation event was happening. Now, XAI isn't publicly traded, so we couldn't see the market, you know, what it did to the market cap. And as I said, he was out raising money for that. Okay, so when the inauguration occurred, you had now, if something improper was going on between Musk as a government special employee working for the chief of staff in the White House, that would be the business of the White House ethics officer. One of the first things that Trump did when he was inaugurated was fire the White House ethics officer. Okay, it's a little bit like, you know, firing the sheriff before the thieves show up, right? Okay, so let's keep going. There were multiple agencies, I think 11, that were either doing investigations of one of Musk's companies or they were doing regulatory actions against Musk companies. And I think it was something like 18 to 20 investigations and regulatory actions that I found and counted. And one of the first things the administration did after they fired the White House ethics office is fired all the inspector generals with a few exceptions. So many of these agencies, it's the action is going to is often brought by the inspector general. So basically, you just fired all the sheriffs around town. Okay. And, you know, I have not followed up with the different agencies to see if they continue on those investigations. But I assure you, if you look at what happens in Washington when somebody moves into that position, that powerful, and all the IGs get fired, the message goes out to everybody in the bureaucracy, you know, just stop. Stop all regulatory actions. We do know that the transition team had said that they were going to cancel the regulation that required accidents and fires by car companies to be reported. And we knew that Tesla was the number one most reported with fires. And they had transition team said they were going to shut down that rule. So, you know, if you look at the potential to improve the market capitalization value of Musk's companies by shutting down all those investigations or regulatory actions or just delaying them. So there was one report that said the group at the FDA who oversees medical equipment that goes in your head, like Neuralink, 20 of them were fired 2 weeks ago. Okay. Which was very coinky dinky. It's very coinky dinky. Okay. So what you see is enormous conflicts of interest. Now, remember, Musk gave, I think, $281 million in campaign contributions. He was the single largest donor. Now, you know, when I was in the Bush administration, you know, generally what you got when you were a major donor is you got presidential cufflinks. Maybe you got invited to the White House to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. You didn't get to systematically lead an effort to go through the federal government, basically racketeering on behalf of your companies. Now, do I think this is corruption? No, I don't think this is corruption. I think this is simply, if you look at the Musk operation, I think you're basically moving data and functions out of the government into that syndicate. This is a privatization on the just do it method. And so you're stripping out data. My guess is you're stripping out data, you're stripping out functions. I mean, if you shut down the weather functions in the government, then every municipality is going to have to get a subscription from the private company that's now offering those weather services, right? So there are many different functions you can privatize just by firing everybody in that function.
So what is the end game here? So
the end game is to let's go back. Let's look at what the control model requires. So now we're talking about building the digital concentration camp. You need digital IDs. You need an all digital monetary system. And what that digital ID and all digital monetary system requires is a massive database, data center infrastructure, which is what you're building with Stargate, right? Okay. So you need the digital ID, you need the all digital monetary system. And if you look at what they're building with their crypto effort, that's basically building towards the all digital monetary system. You need a social credit system. Well, if you privatize all that data into X and XAI and Palantir and all, you know, there's your social credit system. Okay. So let's go back. You need the digital ID, you need the all digital monetary system, you need the data center infrastructure to support that, you need the social credit system, and you need the bankers controlling fiscal policy. And to do that, if you get rid of the civil service, remember, the US government has 6 million people running the operations. You have 3 million contractors, 3 million civil service. If you can strip out the civil service, the problem with the civil service is they require written instructions and they want those written instructions to be in accordance with something that Congress has approved, both authorization and funding. So it's both the authorization legislation and the appropriations in the budget. And generally, it's hard to get them to do much if you don't do that. There are exceptions, you know, people are corrupt, you can get control files on them, there are always exceptions, but to really get operations behind the control of the bankers, you need to get rid of the civil service. So, you know, and they're doing that. So if you look at the progress they're making on digital ID, on digital monetary system, on social credit system, I would mention on January 27th, when XAI announced the deal with Palantir and integration with Palantir's AI, from that point on till about a week and a half ago, Palantir's stock flew up $129 billion. Visa has a deal with X to, you know, they're trying to be the everything app. Visa was up $48
billion. Gee.
So, well, but that gives you a hint of what this kind of data access can mean in terms of if you're Musk and you're building, you know, X into the new financial system, the everything app with Visa and XAI and Palantir and AI. You know, access to this is the most valuable trove of data on the planet.
But Catherine, the COVID era woke a lot of people up. How does Trump or Musk sneak in digital ID?
You saw during the campaign, Trump constantly saying that one of the solutions to our immigration problem and election fraud was digital IDs. You always want to present your control grid as part of a solution to a problem, right? I mean, my assessment is that it was about 6 weeks before the events in Butler and the convention, there was an article in Foreign Affairs basically promoting Trump. And I said to John Titus, you know, so we do the Money and Market show every week on the Solaire Report. And I said to John, mark my word, the Republican establishment has decided that Trump is the guy to get the control grid for them. Now, let me just stop you. And I've been saying this on every show, but I'm going to say it again. This is how the US government works today. Okay. To operate the government, you need to, because we're in a debt-based model, which we don't have to be, but because we are, the the primary dealer network working through the New York Fed go out into the marketplace and in our retirement funds, our pension funds, sovereign wealth funds all over the world, they sell treasury securities, treasury bills, treasury bonds, and they get the money and they put it into the treasury account or the account of the DOD or HUD or the different agencies. So they get the, they go out and they get, you know, almost $2 trillion a year and put it in the bank account. And then they implement the transactions that the government asked them to implement. Okay. If they stop getting that money and they stop implementing the transactions, government stops. They have complete control. Okay. So the only reason the government can do everything they're doing is because the bankers allow them to do it. Do you understand?
Yeah. But then
Trump Trump can't do a thing if the New York Fed says stop. There was a great moment. So we just published, we're publishing a series by John Titus called War for Bankocracy. And in the first episode, we just published the third lesson. It's fabulous. But in the first episode, there's a great clip of a reporter from Politico saying at the beginning of the administration or after President won, but before he's inaugurated, saying to Jay Powell at a press conference, if the president asks you resign, will you? And Powell looks at him and says, no. And then the reporter says, well, you know, can he fire you? And he says, Powell looks at him at her and says, no. That's the relationship. Okay. Now, one of the problems the Fed has, if you want to bring out this, the digital control system, whether you bring it out with CBDC or you bring it out with XRP or Tether or whatever, and we should talk about the crypto, the games that are going on at crypto, because they are really funny and wild. But if you look at the Fed's problem, you know, the civil service in Congress is a problem. Congress can require disclosure. Congress has authority over the Fed. You know, it's not that way in Europe. The ECB is free of the legislative process, but Congress controls and Congress can force disclosure. And Congress can instruct the civil service to operate the executive branch. And the executive branch, you know, the civil service isn't going to follow the instructions if they're not written and they're not in accordance with the budget and the authorizations. So if you're the Fed and you want control of the fiscal line, Trump getting in there and getting rid of the civil service, beating them up and throwing them out, it's great.
Tell me a bit about the crypto Ponzi scheme, as you refer to it.
Okay, so let's look at, because crypto breaks down into many different things. So you have
Sorry, Catherine, just for clarity, crypto and CBDCs are not the same, or are they?
Well, CBDCs and crypto are both digital mechanisms. So CBDCs is digital money issued by the central bank as opposed to issued by the banks. Okay. But right now, if you look at our financial system, you and I use digital money now. I mean, the dollars, 95% of the dollar traffic is digital or more, right? So we're all using digital money now. Okay. It's just that the digital money we're using now is subject to an all infrastructure of laws and regulation. Okay. You know, when you start a crypto, what has been happening? You're out here in the Wild West and you're not subject to these laws and regulations and oversight and everything else. That can be good or bad, you know, whatever. But so let's look at crypto. The largest crypto by a mile is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, I would say, is very different than two other kinds of crypto. One is stable coins. And the other is what is payment mechanisms. So stable coins are basically payment mechanisms that are collateralized by a particular currency or asset. But then we have others that are just payment. So Monero is a payment system that's not collateralized by the dollar. So Tether is the largest stable coin. But we have banks making all sorts of noise that they're going to issue other stable coins. So that market is expected to grow. Bitcoin was the original design was for a payment mechanism. It got hijacked, and now it's basically a Ponzi scheme. So if you come to Solaria, we have a great piece called Bitcoin Bailout, and it includes a link to the book review I did of a wonderful new book published last year called Hijacking Bitcoin, and an interview I did with Steve Patterson, who's the co-author with Roger Ver of that. And it explains how what could have been a really good global payment mechanism got converted into a pump and dump tool, is essentially. So, and then finally, you've got what I call meme coins. And, you know, that's the Wild West of the Wild West, because you've got, it's almost like the crypto version of Tinker Toys. Anyway, great, great fun, but yeah. Okay, so if you look at what's happening, there are a couple things happening, and you have to think of them separately. Stable coins and crypto is in the process of being used to extend the dollar system. So you remember during the Iraqi war how they used to ship over pallets of cash and get everybody using dollars? Right, so you're just pumping out money and getting people off of, you know, the Iraqi dinar and onto dollars. You're building the market share by dollars by giving away money. Okay, so stable coins are the new pallets of cash to Iraq. If there's a country where the currency is not strong, I can go in through the mobile phones and start spreading stable coins, or just literally giving out stable coins and essentially get everybody into the dollar system.
Like Ukraine.
It's a way of building, right. It's a way of building the market share for the dollar and extending the market share for the dollar. So as the BRIC nations are trying to reduce the dollar market share, this is a way you can literally tender, you know, think of, you remember decades ago, you'd have these hostile takeovers where, you know, you buy the stock of one company and one guy takes over the stock of the other company. Well, this is tendering for the global population one mobile phone at a time. You know, and you're just buying market share. And since you can make money out of thin air, you know, I mean, if I can print dollars, then I can literally print stable coin and I can hand them out around the world and get everybody in the dollar market. So stable coins is really an effort to extend the dollar system. And you can also do a lot of other things with it. So, for example, if you want to get everybody holding their money in stable coins, you can get them out of the FDIC system, and you can stop having to provide, you know, basically deposit insurance. So there are many things you can do with it. Okay, now, what can you do with Bitcoin? What you can do with Bitcoin, so an effort is underway to get the federal government and state governments and countries around the world buying Bitcoin. Now, if I were to mandate, what's your favorite dessert? Do you like Jell-O?
Love it.
Okay. If I were to mandate that all the governments around the world had to do long-term buying programs of Jell-O, I could run the price of Jell-O up to the moon, right?
Mm.
Right. Okay. Same with Bitcoin. And so the idea is run the price to the moon. And we've seen this throughout history. Run the price to the moon. And that enables the people who hold the majority of Bitcoin to get out. The problem you have with any kind of Ponzi scheme is the early guys can't get out unless you can bring new guys in. Okay. And by pumping and dumping the price, you've been able to bring some retail in, but nowhere near enough so that the whales, or what I call the Bitcoin billionaires, can get out. The only way they can get out is if you have a massive move. And of course, that's the taxpayers' funding. So what you're watching is the crypto industry give lots of donations, right? And not only donations, but if you look at what they did with Trump's meme coin, I mean, they're, you know, here's the question: who channeled all that money to him,
right?
And what are they going to get in return? That's a very serious question. I don't know if you know this. Apparently, Wired just reported that he's charging $1 million to join him for dinner and $5 million for a one-on-one meet. Well, think about it. If you've announced tariffs, the three auto companies just got a one-month waiver on the tariffs from Canada and Mexico. You know, if you're the three auto companies, did they have to, you know, pay $5 million each for a meeting? I don't know. It's another unanswered question. Okay. So if you run the price of Bitcoin up, and let's look at the trial balloon that Kennedy ran this summer, what he proposed was you mandate long-term purchases. He proposed that it would run the price up dramatically. And then he proposed that that holders of Bitcoin could sell secretly to the government, very convenient if you're a major donor, and they could swap it into real estate on a tax-free basis. Okay? So let's say you bought Bitcoin at almost nothing, at a penny, a Bitcoin, and you run it up. Larry Fink said at Davos that, you know, if this happened, you could run it as high as 700,000. And then you can swap it into real estate secretly and tax-free. So you avoid all the taxes. Now, why would anybody engineer an infrastructure to do that, to let the Bitcoin? So I think the last I looked, you had approximately 2% of the holders holding 70%. Why would you want the Bitcoin billionaires to be able to swap for real estate? Why would you want to do that? Well, what's on the federal balance sheet? So $21 trillion has disappeared. So you've taken the money. And now somebody's sucking out the data, we think, right? What's left? Well, Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce, pointed out during the campaign that the U.S. balance sheet has $500 trillion of land and mineral resources, right? So if you could get government purchases to run Bitcoin up to 700,000 and you could swap in secret for that land, guess what? So we have states in America where 50, 60, 70% of the land in that state is owned by the federal government. Utah, 63% of the land is owned by the federal government. If you privatize all of that, and that's what, you know, they created a sovereign wealth fund and talked about how we're going to monetize the balance sheet. Well, what that means is you're going to turn over control or exploitation of that land or even sell it to private parties. But if you can cause government purchases to run Bitcoin up to 700,000, you can buy it for free. Do you see what I mean?
It's genius.
It's genius. Yeah, it is genius. Now, it's not the first time that the City of London boys have done this, right? Now, here's what's interesting. So the president, there was a lot of pushback against Bitcoin reserves, and we've seen several states now turned down a real push for Bitcoin. And as this debate has grown, you have more and more people like, you know, so Soleri, if you go to Soleri, we publish something called Bitcoin Bailout and basically explained if you have enough money as a government to buy Bitcoin, then you have enough money to lower taxes. In other words, why should I tax you and go invest in a speculative asset? I should simply lower taxes and let you decide what speculative asset you want to buy, if any, right? That's not, government isn't here to speculate and do investment schemes for the citizens, right? You can do that. That's a private function. You should do it. What government should do is it should do essential services that we need government to do, like have working fire hydrants. I would suggest to you that the people of LA would be better if the fire hydrants worked, as opposed to the government buying Bitcoin, right? So here we have the federal government cutting, laying off, cutting, because we need to get current expenses down. $2 trillion is what they're saying. But they're going to go out and they're going to buy into a Ponzi scheme? What's that? Okay, so this is very bad optics. And I think the president knew it was very bad optics and they had backed off on it. But then somebody pressured and there was a tweet coming out that said they were going to consider doing a reserve with XRP and two of the Swiss cryptocurrencies with Solana and Cardano. Okay, so here we have the president proposing a strategic reserve, and two of the three vehicles are based in Zug, Switzerland. How is this part of Make America Great Again? Okay, let me keep going. The next day, you could see he pressured. He comes out with another tweet saying, oh, we're also going to do Ethereum and Bitcoin. Okay, so now we're going to do, so Ethereum, and so you have three cryptos who are based in Zug, Switzerland. XRP is in San Francisco, and Bitcoin is place, not place-based, right? So you have one Ponzi scheme and three payment mechanisms that are based in Switzerland and one that's based in San Francisco. Really? Really? Now, that was Sunday. When he gave his speech on Tuesday, he did not mention crypto, because if you look at the polls, this is not, you know, can you imagine the Make America Great Again guys looking at, okay, we're sending, because while Musk was cutting current expenditures, they were suddenly magically coming up with an equal amount of money to ship off to Israel to proceed with the genocide.
Mm. Yeah, more military.
So, right. So, you know, first it was $1 billion and then I think $7 billion, you know, and you saw the video Trump put out on Gaza with Trump Gaza, and we're going to own it. So basically what we're saying is we're going to cut current expenditures, you know, including a lot that I'm perfectly happy to see cut. And we're going to take the money and we're going to ship it to Israel so they can keep killing the Palestinians. And we're going to buy crypto that's out of Switzerland.
Sure. It's in no way doji.
It's very doji. It's very dodgy.
Yes.
It's very dodgy. We'll put the American enunciation and pronunciation on it. It's very dodgy.
Catherine, this is quite late in the conversation, but you did create the segue earlier, and it's a very important segue, but Bobby Kennedy, is he captured?
So anybody who goes into any of those positions is captured. So it's really funny. I don't know if you saw the post when Bobby went to Bitcoin 2024, the first time he did a trial balloon on Bitcoin, I wrote him and called him screaming. And I spent the next 4 weeks basically doing briefing papers for him and recommending different people that he should get on his economic council. And I was so mad at him. I said, you look like a joke on every trading floor on the planet. What are you doing? You know, and I couldn't figure out where this crazy thing came from. Anyway, so then he goes to Bitcoin 2024, and I was so furious. It was the single most corrupt policy I have ever seen in my life, other than, you know, the Gaza genocide, which he was also supporting. And so I published a thing called, you know, Questions for RFK. But, it, you know, and they were very professionally done, but it was basically reaming him. And that's when he stopped calling me. So I haven't heard hide nor hair from Bobby since. But, you know, those, you know, what he did on Gaza and what he did at Bitcoin 2024 were deeply compromised actions. So, I don't know why. I don't know, you know, what he's up to, but they're deeply compromised actions. Now, I've been a big supporter. I've always wanted to see him go in as HHS secretary, because I've seen what he's accomplished over the last 10 years on the health issues. And I've seen how hard he worked, and I've seen how sincere he is. And I absolutely believe that he really wants to solve the chronic health epidemic. I believe he's totally sincere, and I think his strategy will work if he can get into the bowels of the organizations, get the data, get it published. And I really sincerely believe he's going to try. At the same time, if you look at what's happened to him over the last week, he's getting squeezed and somebody's got a gun to his head badly. So now, you know, if you've gone this far, if you're him, you stay in there and do everything you can to get the data out. And that's what they're trying to stop. Do I believe he's going to try and get the data out? Yeah, I do. Do I think he's deeply compromised and somebody's got a gun to his head? Yeah, I do. But here's the thing. I mean, let me give you an example. I published at the end of the litigation with the Department of Justice, I published a book about what had happened because I felt people needed to understand what had happened. And I published it online because there's so much documentation behind it. But then three times I tried to publish it as a hard copy, and each time it got sabotaged. And the last time, they threatened to kill somebody in my family. Gee. And I really believe that there was a 50% chance or better that they would kill the person. And they were very specific about who it was. And you know, and I backed off. I never published it as a hard copy because I said, you know, I'll wait until everybody involved who's sensitive about this dies. And then I'll publish in a hard copy. But it's already online. It's not censored. And I know it would have gotten a lot more play if I published in a hard copy. But at the same time, until you're in the situation and you know what it's like to get squeezed like that, you know, I back down. It's not, you know, I don't have the right to get somebody in my family killed so that I can get my book out.
And also, so I mean, you know, Bobby's family doesn't have a very good record of surviving.
Right. Right. But, you know, this is what you have to understand. If you look at what they did this week with him on measles, on anti-Semitism, and on the MMR vaccination, it will show you what a dirty business this is. I mean, I've been on a speaking tour with him when I've seen him targeted and what they do to him. And it's the ugliest thing you can imagine. And he handles it very, very well, very patiently, just like if you look at how he handled the confirmation hearings, it was good. But here's our problem. You have 70% of the U.S. population who've taken this injection. And if you look at the disability and deaths that are coming from it, it's extraordinary. And you have at least 70% of the population who are parents who don't want to hear that they've poisoned their children by giving them vaccines. They don't want to know this. They don't want to hear it. But you have a world of corporations and a world of politicians who've basically engineered a mass atrocity. They don't want that to become clear. And it's going to become clear. If he can get the data out, it's going to become clear. Now, let me make it even worse, because I think, you know, the chief scientist officer at Moderna was very clear. He's trying to get an operating system into people's bodies. I mean, he said it. And I think they're right. If you look at the nanoparticles that they've put in the spray, put in the food, put in the injections, they are trying to build what's called the Internet of Bodies. They are trying to digitize life. It's not just us. It's the livestock. It's the tree. I was just on a website. Somebody has a whole presentation, a corporation, a software company, on how they're making the Internet of Forests. So they're building sensors that can digitize all the trees, all the plants, everything in the forest. It's totally insane. But if you look at what they want to do with the Internet of Bodies, their future economic model depends on getting everybody into the network. You need zero leakage. And vaccines are one of the ways you're going to do it. It's part of the control model. So for their control model to work, they need everybody digitized and everybody in the Internet of Bodies. And so I think the ferociousness, it's very much dependent on the fact that they want to go to a new economic model. We've been on the central banking warfare model. They've got a new model, and that model requires basically running the whole planet and the financial system, you know, off of a tokenization of everything, which requires the digitization of everything, including living things, including us.
So what you're telling
me... You're looking very disturbed.
So what you're telling me, Catherine, is that the central bankers always win, big pharma always wins.
No. What I'm saying is they are in a new war with us. It's, you know, David Hughes calls it omni-war. And this war is for all the marbles. This is freedom versus slavery. It's for all the marbles. My prediction is they're going to lose. but I do not underestimate how many people they are going to kill and ruin and destroy on their way to losing. I mean, I think what they're doing is certifiably insane.
Mm. Well, since it's a war, what are your suggestions for fighting?
So there are literally thousands of things you can do. So, and if you come to Solari, we've spent 30 years writing them all up and suggesting them. So I'm not going to try and repeat them all here in 5 minutes. But there are many, many materials that can help. But the first thing I think you need to understand is, there is a spiritual war going on. At the root, this is a spiritual war. And it's divine intelligence versus demonic intelligence. You know, and that plays out into, you know, because culture is the integration of the divine or the demonic in everyday life. And you have to choose which one it is. And the hard part in this world, the hardest thing I find is staying in the divine mind. You know, because things keep happening. The point of a shock and awe strategy is to bring you down into the demonic mind, right? Because you're so overwhelmed and shocked and what's going on. It's to make you incoherent, okay? So step number one is to understand that it's the divine versus the demonic, and you have to choose. You know, we all loved being in the middle of the road. We could get our check and not think about it and still go to church on Sunday and think we were fine. But now there is no middle of the road. You got to choose. And you've got to know why you choose, and you've got to, once you choose, you've got to be ready to, you know, proceed down that road. And so, you know, let's say you choose the divine and you work to make sure you have ways day to day to day to stay in the divine mind, to access the divine mind. Okay. So let's say you've got that squared away. Then the question comes down to all the practical things. How can I generate an income or be economically relevant in this environment in a way that helps others around me? You know, because I'm always telling people, you know, if we can build a for-profit revolution, then we can have a revolution, right? Because it has to be economically sustainable. So part of doing that is, you know, you do what you love, but you do it with a really high learning speed. So you've got to be ruthlessly focused on constantly learning and getting more and more intelligent, including at the new technologies and tools. You know, a lot of the harm is coming through the technology, but technology could be great too.
Like AI?
Well, here's the thing. Somebody said the other day, said, you're not going to be replaced by AI. You're going to be replaced by a guy using AI. And that is true.
Yes.
So this thing, you know, AI is out of the box. It's out of control. It's not going away. So you got to figure out how to use this AI in the divine mind for you, right? So it's just a tool. Now, if you can find a way to do everything in the analog world and not be involved with AI, fine. You know, everybody's different. But by and large, I'm not a believer that you can avoid the tools.
Yeah.
And that's a plan. We got to jump into the middle of the swimming pool and swim, you know, swim down the river, so to speak. Okay. So you've got to find a way to be economically useful and relevant. And you've got to build your life around institutions, companies, businesses, enterprises, and people that have very high integrity. I keep telling people the currency of the future will be relationships of trust. Get the bad dogs out of your life, really. And your survival will depend on who you choose to associate with, and they'll watch your back if you'll watch their back. And you've got to sincerely be there for them. So, and then it goes from there. It helps to be in a good jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So wherever you can get into a good jurisdiction. So my house intent is in Tennessee in the United States, and then I'm here in the Netherlands, and I think those are two of the best jurisdictions in the world.
How can my audience follow your work?
So if you go to Solari.com, we have a subscription service. We have a lot for free. We have this new great series, The War for Bankocracy, from John Titus. John and I do Money and Markets every week, and then we have a great weekly interview. Mark Goodwin just did one on decrypting the new financial system, which is fantastic. And Carolyn and I, it's so funny. So we do a weekly show called Ask Catherine.
Yeah.
And whenever we get a lot of questions on something, we say, okay, we got to roll it up, batch it up, and do a show. And I just had a hissy fit about 6 weeks ago about questions we were getting about the latest financial fraud. So we did something called Navigating the Financial Fraud Minefield. And we literally had to do it in two parts because we had, first, we had a section on what are the behaviors that protect you against financial fraud? Because financial fraud in the United States is, it's like a, it's an epidemic and it's off the charts and it's growing. I mean, it's just exploding. So what are the behaviors that protect you? And then the second section is how do they market it? Because the financial fraud is almost always a 1-2 punch. You know, the first thing is gets you in a state of fear, and then they come in with a, you know, they put you in fear and then here's the solution. And that's how they, you know, it's like, so you have to understand the hook before you understand the fraud. So the second section is on all the different hooks. And then the last section is sort of on some of the frauds we've cleaned up and know and love. I had, when I was an investment advisor, I cleaned up a couple of people from Madoff and I got quite an education.
Catherine, somebody asked me to ask you, what does Solari, however you pronounce it, number one, what and number two, mean? What does it mean?
This is really embarrassing. So I hate this question. So I had a company, you know, when I left the administration, I started a company in Washington and we were trying to figure out the name of the company. And so I was online and I found a reference that said the word Solari was from the Greek and it meant to reduce anxiety through illumination. And that's what a great pricing system or a great currency does. It reduces, it mathematically communicates, I value this at twice what you value it. And it lets all that sort out just through transparency. So a mathematical pricing system does that. So I just love that. And so I went to the team and I said, okay, let's call the new company Solari. And they said, no, it's too weird. It's girly, whatever. And so we called it Hamilton Securities because I'm a great admirer. We were all great admirers of Alexander Hamilton. When I was in the administration, I would be in these meetings and I would be arguing that you can't cancel a contract because it's, you know, You made a contract and you can't cancel it. You can't just pretend and throw it overboard. And we would leave the meeting and I had a deputy say, don't worry, Alexander Hamilton had this fight too and he always won. So it was kind of an inside joke. So we needed Alexander Hamilton, but I love the name Solari and I love the reference. So we created another company that was going to be the money manager and that was going to be Solari. And so when we had to, when Hamilton was litigating and we had to do all the litigation through Hamilton, we brought up Solari to manage the litigation process. And then finally we merged Hamilton into Solari and the two got integrated under the name Solari. So that's where the name Solari came from. And since then I've tried to find the reference and I can't. And so I was in New York with a venture capitalist and I told him the name of the company was Solari. He freaked out because his favorite video game character was an angel or something named Solari. And, you know, so there's another reference, but, and there are other references too in science fiction. But anyway, so on my list to do is to hire an ancient Greek scholar. So if you're a scholar who does ancient Greece and you're interested in a project to go find the original meanings in the ancient Greek, you know, I'm interested, contact me at Solari.com. But it's on my list to do that, but I'm embarrassed to admit that I can't find the reference again. So anyway, so I thought it was from the ancient Greek to reduce anxiety through elimination.
Catherine Austin-Fitz, God bless you. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
God bless you, Jerm. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.